for some reason, while sitting there in the silence, I had two jokes come to mind that were not part of my intended script. But the last couple of weeks, when Daniel has read the New Testament reading, I always, you know, when you get a joke that sticks in your head for the rest of your life after you hear it once, and it's just something triggers it. Keep remembering this sketch from an Irish comedian called Dave Allen back in the 70s, who on one of his TV shows, dressed perfectly as a priest, came into the lectern and said, "Today's reading is from Paul's letter to Timothy. Dear Tim, having a lovely time. Wish you were here. Love, Paul." And it always comes back to my head whenever I hear a reading from Timothy. The other is I believe this is a true story, and it was just triggered by that image of the turning of the tables in the gospel reading. I believe it's a true story that on an occasion on an air flight, a passenger objected to being sat next to a black man in the and he called the stewardess and said, "This is totally preposterous that I should be seated here." And the stewardess looked at him and said, "Sir, I quite understand the problem. He certainly shouldn't be sitting next to you." And she turned to the black man and said, "Excuse me, sir, we have a seat for you in business class," and upgraded him. Yeah. There were thousands of extraordinary stories, also some of which to do with aeroplanes, in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks that brought down the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center 15 years ago. Many of those stories were inspiring and heartwarming, and others were depressing, and some were nearly as terrifying as the attacks themselves. And one of the more perverse stories was the eagerness to reopen the Wall Street Stock Exchange as quickly as possible. It became obvious then, if there had ever been any doubt, that the stock exchange is one of the great temples of a major world religion. The reopening was spoken of in religious terms as being a tribute to those who had lost their lives, as being a much-needed sign that the fundamental fabric of American society and culture was not destroyed, and therefore as a cause for celebration and confidence. Those who do not belong to that particular religious persuasion might describe the Wall Street reopening in quite different terms. They might see the stock exchange merely as a place where people driven by greed go about the business of accumulating as much of the world's wealth into their own hands as they possibly can. They might characterise the eagerness to reopen it as people saying, "Thousands of people were murdered next door. Gee, that's too bad. Oh, well, let's get back to making more money." They might see it as more like a callous insult to the dead than a moving tribute. Of course, the people who voice views like that are either failing to recognise the religious nature of economics, or they are devotees of some other religion who are seeking to discredit that religion in favour of their own. I'm one of the second group. There's nothing new in the idea that a commitment to the accumulation of wealth is a religious commitment that conflicts with Christian faith. It was pretty clearly articulated in the reading that we heard from Paul's letter to Timothy, just before he said, "Having a lovely time, wish you were here." The apostle said flat out that there are all kinds of evils that have their roots in the love of money, and that an eagerness for wealth erodes any commitment to Jesus, leading people far from the faith and making them highly susceptible to corruption and compromise. Timothy is told to shun such paths and to fight the good fight of the faith instead. Perhaps, though, the area that best shows up the religious nature of this conflict is the respective visions of future salvation offered by these two conflicting faith systems. To those who hold an economic faith, the vision of salvation is a world of unlimited economic growth and the free movement of capital and commodities. This is a vision for which they are willing to advocate enormous sacrifice. It's recognised that there is often enormous pain and hardship as the economy of a nation is deregulated and inefficient industries are closed or restructured. But such pain and sacrifice is worth it, they say, for the achievement of economic heaven. The sceptics might say that those making the sacrifices and those reaping the benefits are seldom the same people. They might also point out that there is something inherently contradictory about championing the free movement of money and commodities while erecting more and more barriers to the free movement of people. For all their pious talk of trickle-down effects and the like, the presence of more and more of the world's poor knocking at the door somehow doesn't seem to have a place in their doctrine. The language of economics might be different now, but the Apostle Paul recognised that the devotees of wealth had their own vision of salvation. And he tells Timothy to instruct any rich Christians to be careful not to set their hopes on riches. He suggests that instead, if anyone wants to set themselves up with a solid foundation for the future, they should do it by investing themselves in generous sharing and in doing good for others. Such a statement is obviously coming out of a quite different vision of the future, a quite different vision of the nature of salvation. The vision that Jesus offers is of the unlimited growth of love and of the reconciliation of all things in God. In this vision, people discover the freedom of simplicity and are able to find real joy and pleasure in simple things that money often can't buy. This vision doesn't rule out buying and owning material things, but it does say that they are not the be-all and end-all, and that our ownership and use of those things is subordinate to the things that matter in the culture of God. In our first reading, we heard of the prophet Jeremiah buying a block of land as a prophetic sign of hope. Jerusalem was about to be overrun by an invading army, and so Jeremiah's purchase looked a little bit like investing in the deck chairs on board the Titanic after it hit the iceberg. But Jeremiah made his purchase with his eyes open, and he did it not as a speculative investment in post-war property booms, but as a bold witness to a hope in God's promise to bring the people home from exile and to re-establish them on their ancestral homelands. Jeremiah was putting his money where his mouth was. And he was doing so in his prophetic mission to awaken the people to an alternative vision of the future, a vision in which God's culture of love and mercy and hope take root and hold sway over our lives. In this vision of the unlimited growth of love, there is a dismantling of the borders and boundaries and a lifting up of the poor that they might share equally in the banquet of life. When a wealthy country like ours is investing obscene amounts of money in border protection to keep people out, the people who are supposed to be making our sports shoes in the sweatshops of South Asia, the story Jesus told in tonight's reading comes horrifyingly close to home. We feast on plenty and try to keep the poor outside the gate. But what we are doing is destroying ourselves. Don't fall for the common mistake of thinking that this story from Jesus tells us just what heaven and hell are and what they look like. Jesus was simply using a popular story and putting his own spin on it to make a point. It was a bit like all those jokes that we have about people arriving at the pearly gates. We don't literalise the details of those stories, and neither should we with this one. It functions the same way. But Jesus is using the story to tell us some things that really, really do matter. He's warning us that the way that we treat one another, and especially the way that we treat those in the most desperate need, is creating habits and corrupting our spirits and entrenching us in patterns that we will find increasingly difficult to get out of. Perhaps like the rich man in the story, by the time our eyes are opened to what we've been doing, we will have created such an unbridgeable chasm around ourselves that even if we wanted to begin to love, we'd no longer be able to reach anybody or be reached by anybody. Let me come back to the contrasts that Paul drew for a minute, because he makes another important point for us. He says that the life to which we've been called, the life without limit, is not gained without struggle. It's not easy to break free from the patterns we have entrenched ourselves in, the patterns of the culture around us with its conflicting religious commitments, to embrace instead the culture of Jesus. We have to fight for this new life, to fight the good fight, as Paul puts it. And when you begin to look at the clash between Christian faith and economic faith, you can see how right he was. Because the devotees of wealth have a seemingly unlimited marketing budget. However committed we might be to not following their doctrines, we can't go anywhere or do anything without being exposed to a saturation campaign extolling the joys and virtues of the economic consumer culture. Every imaginable good thing in life can be purchased, so we are told, if only we have the money. And we are told that everywhere we look and everywhere we listen, almost 24 hours a day. If we want to live out a different faith and a contrasting vision of future salvation without succumbing to that endless message, it's going to require struggle. It's going to require us to take active steps to immerse ourselves in the alternative vision and nourish within and among us a passionate hunger for the culture of the kingdom of God. That's one of the reasons it's so important for us to gather here each Sunday and to maintain our practices of daily prayer, whether physically together when we can or more often scattered but united in spirit and prayer. When we do these things together, we are creating and ingraining new habits, new visions. Gathered here around this table, we continue to celebrate this subversive alternative vision and to open ourselves to the Christ who meets us here and shapes within us a new spirit. We listen to the one who rose from the dead and whose stories challenge the heresies that constantly bombard us. And we commit ourselves to the living out of stories of compassion, love, hope, and peace, rather than the stories of greed, arrogance, and callous indifference. If these alternative visions and stories had no more power than those that are being told by the devotees of wealth, they'd probably never compete with the bombardment. But these stories pulse with the power that raised Jesus from the dead. So in that hope, we gather here around this book, around this table, praying that God's will be done, praying for God's culture to emerge. And we eat and drink the first fruits of our salvation until he comes. There's a tough struggle ahead of us, but Jesus is leading the way.